Listen, fella, if you go around fraternizing, how are you going to govern them?
Govern them? Just let them know who their bread and beef's coming from. Just let them know that, and we'll govern them all right.
Sure, sure. And that was one reason they fell for Hitler.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, May 12, 1946, we present the 26th in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today,
the calendar of peace.
Days, a year and 5 days have passed since the ending of the war in Europe.
Here at home and abroad, these were days of the beginnings of reconstruction, reconversion, the first steps on the road to peace.
How far and in what manner have we traveled on that road? What is there noted on the pages as we review the past year in
the calendar of peace?
This is Robert St. John in New York. To anyone thinking back over the days of the year just past, it seems that never before has there been such a year. Never before have there been a years of days so packed with clamor for decision, with questions to be weighed and answered, questions and decisions that will shape the lives of the 2 billion inhabitants of this planet called Earth. Today we shall recall to you some of the events which marked the past 370 days. We shall summarize and bring up to date the charts of our movements toward peace. We shall call in our NBC correspondents from the action centers of the world, Roy Porter from Nuremberg, Henry Cassidy from Paris, George Thomas Folster from Tokyo.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington. There are innumerable places of action and decision these days, but the attention of the entire world focuses on the United States. And from this capital city, the center of reconversion activity, will come our report on the American scene. And W.W. Chaplin, one of the correspondent witnesses, will describe the event that marks May 7th, 1945, as a special day forever.
The day came quietly upon a world that had been waiting for it for 5 long, bitter years. It came almost anticlimactically, after the brief frenzy of a false armistice some days before. The final scene began for us with a phone ringing early in the morning of May 6 in a room in the Hotel Scribe in Paris.
NBC, Richardson.
This is Schaaf, Collins speaking.
Oh, hello, Collins. How's it going?
Fine. I'm kind of busy right now. Look, have one of the boys stand by. Something's going to break.
That all?
That's all, right now.
Hey, Bill. Bill, wake up.
What time is it now, Pierre?
20 minutes after 2.
Thanks. Another one, please.
Pardon me, are you Chaplin, NBC?
Yes, I'm Chaplin.
You got your credentials for that special assignment?
Yeah, I'm all set.
Okay, there's a bus waiting in the courtyard. Get on it, fast.
Right. Say, Pierre.
Oui, monsieur.
Cancel that order.
Oui.
Those guys were sure burned up.
Yeah, I thought the bus was going to run right into Wayne when we pulled away from the hotel.
Can't blame them much. How many did get aboard?
17. I counted when we got on.
Maybe it's going to take place in a phone booth.
You think this is the break, Bill?
It must be. Look, Hank, the Palace of Versailles.
Yeah, a monument to a lost peace. Let's hope it goes better this time.
Amen to that.
Would you gentlemen be quiet, please? General Allen wants to speak to all the correspondents.
Oh, that's all. Can you all hear me?
Yes, General. That's all right.
Well, gentlemen, we are going to Reims to cover the signing of the peace. You will all witness the ceremony. But this story is off the record until the respective governments announce it. Therefore, I pledge you on your honor not to communicate the results of this conference or the fact of its existence until it is released by Schaefer.
Yeah, we got it.
The time in New York is 9:16 a.m. on May 8, 1945. This is W.W. Chaplin from Allied Supreme Headquarters in Paris. The war in Europe is at last over, and I was witness to the signatures that resulted in the unconditional surrender of Germany. Acting as special emissary of Hitler's successor, Colonel General Gustav Jodl surrendered all of Germany to all of the Allies, including Russia, at 2:41 o'clock yesterday morning. General Jodl signed the papers in General Eisenhower's war room while seated not more than 10 feet from where I was standing. I was so close that I could see a drop of perspiration running slowly down his fat, flat face onto his jutting chin, his signature writing finished to the nightmarish history of Nazism. Then this flat-faced general rose slowly to his feet and made one of the strangest little speeches in history.
The German people, the German armed forces are, for better or worse, delivered into the victor's hands. In this war, which has lasted more than 5 years, the German people and armed forces have achieved and suffered more than perhaps any other people in the world. In this hour, I can only express the hope that the victor will treat them with generosity.
Standing close behind him, I noticed that there was a chart showing Allied casualties with a total in 7 figures. Beside that chart, he stood and begged for generosity. As he made his speech, Jodl looked across the table at the Allied generals, Russian, French, British, and American. And just behind him, I watched their faces, too. They were impassive, unresponsive, as blank as the windows in back of them. Without another word, General Jodl picked up his cap and walked out of the room. Then the others signed the surrender document. Then it was done, all in 4 minutes. A war that lasted almost 6 years was ended just like that, in 4 minutes.
And then the roar of celebration went up all over the world. In Manhattan, 500,000 people jammed into Times Square, and tons of ticker tape whitened the streets. At LaGuardia Field, a chaplain led a dozen wounded soldiers in prayer alongside the transport plane that had brought them from Europe.
We thank thee for the end of the conflict in the world.
In London, in Rome, in Oslo, in Paris, and Palestine, the day of victory was marked big and red. In Atlanta, Georgia, there were more people in the churches and synagogues than there were at the baseball game, Atlanta versus Little Rock. And in a middle western town, a woman called the local newspaper office.
Hello? Hello? I'd like some information. I want to bake a pie this afternoon. I wonder if you could read me the recipe that was in the paper last Saturday?
And in a Kansas City bar, the bartender went into the back room for a few minutes to write a letter to his brother in Germany.
Dear Chris, the news is official now, and 6 times in the last hour, it's strangers buying drinks for the house, and everybody going a little crazy. And it's okay, because it was a good job and you were in there helping to do it. But for me, there won't be any celebration till you come home. Then we'll put it on good. I have waited for this day a long time. I'll be seeing you soon. God bless you and the whole world.
This is Robert McCormick. On the day in question, I was on the island of Guam. Out there in the Pacific, several thousand Americans and Australians observed VE Day by killing Japanese soldiers in such places as Tarakan and Okinawa and the Philippines.
Well, kid, it's happy days in Dixie for the guys in Europe.
Yeah, here it's just another working day. Now, but the sun's beginning to shine a little more now.
You bet. Now we can get all that stuff we need for our war. Now we can win it and get home before we figure.
Okay, the ammo's in. Let her sink.
Right.
And thus ended the first of the 370 days. Now, on the agenda of the Allies were two main items of business. One, to finish quickly the war with Japan. Two, to sit down seriously to the arithmetic of peace. On VE Day plus 49...
We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war.
To reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small.
The delegates of 51 nations meeting in San Francisco had adopted a charter, a blueprint for the peace machinery of the world. John Foster Dulles, chief consultant to the United States delegation, reported to the Federal Council of Churches,
"The San Francisco conference was not a conference which merely ratified a text which the big powers presented. The San Francisco conference performed a great task of creation. It gave birth to an instrument which can be a Magna Carta for the world."
The Charter of the United Nations dealt carefully and minutely with the abstract mechanics of peace. But to decide the hard realities, colonies and real estate, reparations, the spoils of war, another body was needed.
In the latter weeks of July, President Truman, Prime Minister Churchill, and Generalissimo Stalin met in Berlin and Potsdam.
On July 25th, the conference was interrupted for 2 days. England held its first general election since the war. The Labour Party was voted into power, and Clement Attlee returned to the conference as Prime Minister. And 5 days later, the conference announced its decisions.
The first point of agreement provides for establishment of a Council of Foreign Ministers representing the five principal powers: the United States, Great Britain, Russia, China, and France, to continue the necessary preparatory work for the peace settlements.
The machinery for peace and the plans came forth, some idealistic, some concrete. On September 2nd at 9:08 a.m., aboard the battleship Missouri, NBC correspondent Merrill Muller reported to the world.
Representative of Japan.
Mr. Mamoru Shigemitsu, Foreign Minister of the Japanese government, is stepping forward to sit down at the table and sign the instrument of surrender. His will be the first signature on behalf of Japan, surrendering all Japanese armed forces, and committing the Japanese people to obey all orders of the Supreme Commander, General Douglas MacArthur.
War now was officially ended everywhere in the world, and the days of total peace began officially. But the going was rather slow. The road was beset with many a minor conflict. The road was tough and uphill all the way. The political headwinds were fierce and they were bitter.
We of the occupation forces in Germany and Japan have a task to do, and it's a hard one: to destroy war potential while building a belief in democratic ideals.
And in the early months of the occupation of Germany, an actress returned from a USO tour of Europe and reported,
"It's enough to make you so sick that you want to scream it out. The soldiers who won the war on the bloody battlefields of Europe are now losing the peace to the women of Germany."
But in Germany, two GIs saw the matter somewhat differently.
"It's just plain stupid, this non-fraternization business."
"What do you mean, stupid?"
"Well, what I mean is, after all, we're supposed to educate these Germans back to normal citizens. This way, we're just raising a barrier between us and them.
Listen, fella, you're dead wrong. We've got to teach them we're the boss now. And if you go around fraternizing, well, then they have influence over you, and, well, how are you going to govern them?
Govern them? Just let them know who their bread and beef's coming from. Just let them know that. We'll govern them, all right.
Sure, sure. And that was one reason they fell for Hitler.
Oh, look, soldier, I don't mind discussing fraternization and things like that, but please, no politics.
To destroy the war potential while building a belief in democratic ideals, that is the goal of our occupation of Germany. Now, on VE Day plus 369, how far have we come? For an answer from our sector of occupation, we call in from Nuremberg NBC's correspondent in Germany, Roy Porter.
The military occupation of Germany in the first year has succeeded only partly. The American army is not in command, neither is the military government. All you have to do to confirm this is simply to be in Nuremberg this weekend when two GIs got shot in ambush, and not even the professional detectives can tell you who did the job. Today, many squads of military policemen went through the district of northern Nuremberg, but what they found lent nothing to the solution of the case. The primary reason is this. There is no basic policy for the American occupation of Germany. The War Department has shied away from it. The State Department has avoided the problem. Hard-headed, realistic Russians have made their occupation stick. We have not, because we have not yet realized that Nazis cannot be converted in a few months or a few years. Food is playing a tremendous part in this program. And when food and the process of getting rid of the Nazis in power come into conflict, food wins. The people, including ourselves, must eat. And if it's a question of a Nazi Burgermeister or a dish of fresh carrots, we'll take the fresh carrots. I merely suggest that America, having won the war, might begin taking a new point of view that, after all, we are going to win the peace. This is Roy Porter in Germany, returning you to the National Hour.
In the weeks that followed VE Day, the world's common vocabulary was charged with new words. UN, Council of Foreign Ministers, Atomic Power, Potsdam Declaration. But for the past 4 months, two ancient words, words as old as war itself, have haunted the world. Hunger, famine. In an Italian schoolroom, the children study the political climate of a new world.
And this type of government is called, Pietro? What is it called?
It is called democracy.
Good. What does democracy mean?
Democracy means where the people rule. And it means that you don't have to be afraid and...
Yes, go on.
And in a democracy, there is no hunger. And... Oh, Signor, excuse me. I have to sit down.
What is it, Pietro? Are you ill? Tell me, Pietro. Did you eat this morning?
No, Signor. There has been nothing since the day before yesterday.
In the countries of Europe and Asia, bread has become not only an item of nutrition, but an international political weapon.
Certainly we are interested in democracy, freedom, the concept of one world. But of what use is the right to vote if we are too hungry to care what we are voting for?
The days turn on the calendar of peace. How far has the world come? Well, for another link in the chain of answer, we take you now to Paris and to NBC correspondent Henry Cassidy.
In the year since VE Day, Western Europe has made surprising progress in reconstruction.
A year ago, this continent was faced with staggering problems of rebuilding smashed homes and reviving ruined industries. But today, after traveling through these countries and studying their statistics, I can report as a broad generality that Western Europe is already more than halfway back on the road to normalcy. The next half of the road will be harder. Both France and the Netherlands, for example, calculate that it will take 10 years for them to complete their reconstruction. The best way to characterize the situation is to say that the emergency first aid treatment has now been done, but the convalescence will be long. The most immediate need here was in physical reconstruction. In England, more than 3 million buildings were wrecked, but nearly half of them have now had some sort of repairs. In France, 1.5 million buildings were hit, but more than 1 million have been repaired at least temporarily. No one in Western Europe today needs to be without shelter. Despite shortages of raw materials, tools, and manpower, French industrial production has risen to 60% of its 1938 level. Belgian production is close to the pre-war scale, and England, wartime arsenal that was never occupied by the enemy, is producing more than she did before the war. All these countries lack the consumer's goods and luxury items that make life more pleasant, but all of them are turning out more electric power than they ever did before. Each part of Europe has its own special problem. France had 1 million acres of minefields to clear. 800,000 of them have been neutralized. The Netherlands lost 8% of its farmlands under floods. More than half of these fields are now dry. In the long period of reconstruction still to come, Europe is counting greatly on outside help, particularly from the United States, but she has already done a great deal to put her own house in order. This is Henry Cassidy at NBC Paris, returning you to the National Hour.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington. Well, these days, a world groping towards stability and peace looks to the United States. With the United Nations now headquartered in this country, we have become the center of gravity for balancing the entire world. Yet we ourselves are groping. Our foreign policy is blurred by differences between the President and Congress. Our domestic policy is caught in cross currents that threaten to twist it to pieces. We haven't yet defined even our methods of handling the most powerful single influence in the world today, the influence of atomic energy. But slowly, painfully, we are straightening ourselves out. After weeks of argument, for example, the Senate finally passed and sent to the House legislation authorizing a loan to Britain. We have definitely decided to be tough with Russia, to be fair with her by our standards, but to refuse to be buffaloed. We are even maneuvering around toward a fixed program of keeping and developing our bases in the Pacific. Domestically, President Truman's program of making a friend of Congress has been a dismal failure. The president's legislative program of more than 20 points has been knocked around from pillar to post. Even the OPA, one of the most important items in Mr. Truman's program, has taken a dreadful beating so far in Congress. We do not have an extension of the draft, nor do we have compulsory peacetime military training, or a merger of the Army and Navy, or a dozen other measures most urgently wanted by the President. But even here, we are beginning to feel our way out of the darkness. The President's emergency housing program, as an instance, may get underway within a few days. Perhaps the biggest shock we had here was the sudden realization we are up against a food shortage. Ideas on how to meet the food crisis differ within the administration. So far, about all we can be sure of is that the world, and consequently this country, do not have enough food. And the situation will improve very, very little in the next couple of years. Also, we have our labor troubles. The president worked out a formula for handling strikes based on giving price increases to meet the extra cost of pay raises necessary to settle labor difficulties. Then along comes the coal strike, and neither pay nor prices is a primary consideration. Yet even here, we are making progress. The coal strike is off, at least temporarily. Until we get our own thoughts organized, until we can ourselves move quickly and certainly, we cannot meet our obligation as world leaders. But like the frog in the well, we climb 2 feet and slide back 1. But we are getting there.
To destroy the forces of militarism, to build democratic ideals, those are our goals. How far are we along the road today on VJ Day plus 266? What's the answer from Tokyo? We go now to the headquarters of Occupation in the Pacific and to NBC correspondent George Thomas Folster.
The outstanding signposts of accomplishment along our occupation road are found in the fields of economy, politics, and education. The big monopolies, feudal family affairs here in Japan, have been dealt stinging blows. The job is far from finished, but the groundwork and policies have been shaped for the smashing of these big industrial machines, especially insofar as their war-making potential is concerned. The political picture is less definite, but as sure as Japan lies conquered today, she has been started on the road to freedom. The big question is obvious. Can she, will she maintain a continued, if faltering, pace toward the democratic way of life? Her recent and first free election was a good omen. The educational aims under Allied supervision remains the most hopeful program of all our endeavors, for the Japanese must be educated away. They cannot be cut away. So if they understand, they will find it easier to believe. The work of the education section continues to be effective. You see it in the now outspoken Japanese radio and press, in the new labor unions, the emancipation of Japanese women, and in politics, business, and schools. Remember, however, as sure as education is the soundest and surest way, it is also the longest way. It takes time, patience, and good example by the Allies working together. Constructive progress is apparent in Japan, but stand back in time as it is measured by historians, and you see we have only broken the trail. This is George Thomas Folster, NBC Tokyo, returning you to the National Hour.
The calendar of the first year since the war's end has been the subject of our documentary, and this is what we have learned.
On the world's calendar, the date is now VE plus 369. In those days, we have seen the occupation of Germany, the defeat and the occupation of Japan. But neither we nor our allies have as yet agreed in detail on what to do with Germany, what to do with Europe. The United Nations is in operation, but the going seems slow. With the exception of the guns booming in Manchuria, there is no fighting war in the world. But famine sits black on Europe and Asia. Drought, economic dislocation, crop failures cloud the world abroad. And in this country, management labor strife and divergent interests in the government have set up detours on the road to reconversion. Groping, stumbling, but at the same time working and hoping, the world is slowly finding its bearings. It is moving, we can sincerely hope, on toward the magnetic pole of peace.
On the subject of the calendar year since VE Day, then, our documentary is closed.
But here is a bulletin on this 370th day since VE Day, a bulletin which has just come in over the wires into the NBC newsroom. The province of Azerbaijan has just declared war on the central government of Iran. This was reported by the Tabriz radio, according to a Reuters dispatch. The broadcast on the Tabriz radio said, quote, "We declare war against Iran, and the National Army is marching on Tehran." And now this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen to the National Hour again next Sunday, when our subject will be Gateway to a Land of Freedom. What will be our policy on immigration?
This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York and Washington, and from our news staffs in Tokyo, Paris, and Nuremberg, we have brought you the 26th of NBC series on current affairs and national problems. Robert Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.